Have you seen Chuck Norris lately? He's still kicking butt and staying active well into his 80s. What's even more shocking is he looks more jacked than ever and seems to have more energy than guys half his age. And it's all thanks to Morning Kick, a revolutionary new daily drink from Roundhouse Provisions that combines ultra-potent greens like spirulina and kale with probiotics, prebiotics, collagen, and even ashwagandha. Just mix with water, stir, and enjoy. Unlike other green drinks out there, this one tastes exactly like strawberry lemonade and has hundreds of five-star reviews. Go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 for up to 44% off your regular priced order. Plus, every purchase is backed by a 90-day money-back guarantee. So if you want to experience smoother digestion, a boost of energy, and just an overall healthier body, then go to roundhouseprovisions.com/save44 today. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Results can vary.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 3 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar, Chapter 3, Shooting the Chutes and After. Through the fog I felt my way along by means of my compass. I no longer heard the bears, nor did I encounter one within the fog. Experience has since taught me that these great beasts are as terror-stricken by this phenomenon as a landsman by a fog at sea, and that no sooner does a fog envelop them than they make the best of their way to lower levels and a clear atmosphere. It was well for me that this was true. I felt very sad and lonely as I crawled along the difficult footing. My own predicament weighed less heavily upon me than the loss of Perry, for I loved the old fellow. That I should ever win the opposite slopes of the range I began to doubt, for though I am naturally sanguine, I imagine that the bereavement which had befallen me had cast such a gloom over my spirits that I could see no slightest ray of hope for the future. Then, too, the blighting gray oblivion of the cold damp clouds through which I wandered was distressing. Hope thrives best in sunlight, and I am sure that it does not thrive at all in a fog. But the instinct of self-preservation is stronger than hope. It thrives, fortunately, upon nothing. It takes root upon the brink of the grave, and blossoms in the jaws of death. Now it flourished bravely upon the breast of dead hope, and urged me onward and upward in a stern endeavor to justify its existence. As I advanced, the fog became denser. I could see nothing beyond my nose. Even the snow and ice I trod were invisible. I could not see below the breast of my bearskin coat. I seemed to be floating in a sea of vapor. To go forward over a dangerous glacier under such conditions was little short of madness, but I could not have stopped going had I known positively that death lay 2 paces before my nose. In the first place, it was too cold to stop, and in the second, I should have gone mad but for the excitement of the perils that beset each forward step. For some time the ground had been rougher and steeper, until I had been forced to scale a considerable height that had carried me from the glacier entirely. I was sure from my compass that I was following the right general direction, and so I kept on. Once more the ground was level. From the wind that blew about me I guessed that I must be upon some exposed peak of ridge. And then, quite suddenly, I stepped out into space. Wildly I turned and clutched at the ground that had slipped from beneath my feet. Only a smooth, icy surface was there. I found nothing to clutch or stay my fall, and a moment later so great was my speed that nothing could have stayed me. As suddenly as I had pitched into space, with equal suddenness did I emerge from the fog, out of which I shot like a projectile from a cannon into clear daylight. My speed was so great that I could see nothing about me but a blurred and indistinct sheet of smooth and frozen snow that rushed past me with express train velocity. I must have slid downward thousands of feet before the steep incline curved gently onto a broad, smooth, snow-covered plateau. Across this I hurtled with slowly diminishing velocity, until at last objects about me began to take definite shape. Far ahead, miles and miles away, I saw a great valley and mighty woods, and beyond these a broad expanse of water. In the nearer foreground I discerned a small, dark blob of color upon the shimmering whiteness of the snow. A bear, thought I, and thanked the instinct that had impelled me to cling tenaciously to my rifle during the moments of my awful tumble. At the rate I was going, it would be but a moment before I should be quite abreast the thing. Nor was it long before I came to a sudden stop in soft snow, upon which the sun was shining, not 20 paces from the object of my most immediate apprehension. It was standing upon its hind legs waiting for me. As I scrambled to my feet to meet it, I dropped my gun in the snow and doubled up with laughter. It was Parry. The expression upon his face, combined with the relief I felt at seeing him again safe and sound, was too much for my overwrought nerves.
"David!" he cried. "David, my boy! God has been good to an old man. He has answered my prayer."
It seems that Parry, in his mad flight, had plunged over the brink at about the same point as that at which I had stepped over at a short time later. Chance had done for us what long periods of rational labor had failed to accomplish. We had crossed the divide. We were upon the side of the Mountains of the Clouds that we had for so long been attempting to reach. We looked about. Below us were green trees and warm jungles. In the distance was a great sea. "The Lurel Az," I said, pointing toward its blue-green surface. Somehow, the gods alone can explain it, Parry, too, had clung to his rifle during his mad descent of the icy slope. For that there was cause for great rejoicing. Neither of us was worse for his experience, so after shaking the snow from our clothing, we set off at a great rate down toward the warmth and comfort of the forest and the jungle. The going was easy by comparison with the awful obstacles we had had to encounter upon the opposite side of the divide. There were beasts, of course, but we came through safely. Before we halted to eat or rest, we stood beside a little mountain brook beneath the wondrous trees of the primeval forest, in an atmosphere of warmth and comfort. It reminded me of an early June day in the Maine woods. We fell to work with our short axes and cut enough small trees to build a rude protection from the fiercer beasts. Then we lay down to sleep. How long we slept I do not know. Parry says that, inasmuch as there is no means of measuring time within Pellucidar, there can be no such thing as time here, and that we may have slept an outer earthly year, or we may have slept but a second. But this I know. We had stuck the ends of some of the saplings into the ground in the building of our shelter, first stripping the leaves and branches from them, and when we awoke we found that many of them had thrust forth sprouts. Personally, I think we slept at least a month. But who may say? The sun marked midday when we closed our eyes, it was still in the same position when we opened them. Nor had it varied a hair's breadth in the interim. It is most baffling, this question of elapsed time within Pellucidar. Anyhow, I was famished when we awoke. I think that it was the pangs of hunger that awoke me. Ptarmigan and wild boar fell before my revolver within a dozen moments of my awakening. Parry soon had a roaring fire blazing by the brink of the little stream. It was a good and delicious meal we made. Though we did not eat the entire boar, we made a very large hole in him, while the ptarmigan was but a mouthful. Having satisfied our hunger, we determined to set forth at once in search of Anorak and my old friend, Jah the Mizop. We each thought that by following the little stream downward we should come upon the large river which Ja had told me emptied into the Lural Az opposite his island. We did so, nor were we disappointed. For at last, after a pleasant journey, and what journey would not be pleasant after the hardships we had endured among the peaks of the Mountains of the Clouds, we came upon a broad flood that rushed majestically onward in the direction of the great sea we had seen from the snowy slopes of the mountains. For three long marches we followed the left bank of the growing river, until at last we saw it roll its mighty volume into the vast waters of the sea. Far out across the rippling ocean we descried three islands. The one to the left must be Anorak. At last we had come close to a solution of our problem, the road to Sari. But how to reach the islands was now the foremost question in our minds. We must build a canoe. Perry is a most resourceful man. He has an axiom which carries the thought kernel that what man has done, man can do, and it doesn't cut any figure with Perry whether a fellow knows how to do it or not. He set out to make gunpowder once, shortly after our escape from Phutra and at the beginning of the Confederation of the Wild Tribes of Pellucidar. He said that someone, without any knowledge of the fact that such a thing might be concocted, had once stumbled upon it by accident, and so he couldn't see why a fellow who knew all about powder, except how to make it, couldn't do as well. He worked mighty hard mixing all sorts of things together, until finally he evolved a substance that looked like powder. He had been very proud of the stuff, and had gone about the village of the Saurians exhibiting it to everyone who would listen to him, and explaining what its purpose was and what terrific havoc it would work, until finally the natives became so terrified at the stuff that they wouldn't come within a rod of Perry and his invention. Finally, I suggested that we experiment with it and see what it would do. So Perry built a fire, after placing the powder at a safe distance, and then touched a glowing ember to a minute particle of the deadly explosive. It extinguished the ember. Repeated experiments with it determined me that in searching for a high explosive, Perry had stumbled upon a fire extinguisher that would have made his fortune for him back in our own world. So now he set himself to work to build a scientific canoe. I had suggested that we construct a dugout, but Perry convinced me that we must build something more in keeping with our positions of supermen in this world of the Stone Age. "We must impress these natives with our superiority," he explained. "You must not forget, David, that you are Emperor of Pellucidar. As such, you may not with dignity approach the shores of a foreign power in so crude a vessel as a dugout." I pointed out to Perry that it wasn't much more incongruous for the Emperor to cruise in a canoe than it was for the Prime Minister to attempt to build one with his own hands. He had to smile at that. But in extenuation of his act, he assured me that it was quite customary for prime ministers to give their personal attention to the building of imperial navies. "And this," he said, "is the imperial navy of His Serene Highness David the First, Emperor of the Federated Kingdoms of Pellucidar." I grinned, but Perry was quite serious about it. It had always seemed rather more or less of a joke to me that I should be addressed as Majesty and all the rest of it, yet my imperial power and dignity had been a very real thing during my brief reign. 20 tribes had joined the Federation, and their chiefs had sworn eternal fealty to one another and to me. Among them were many powerful, though savage, nations. Their chiefs we had made kings, their tribal lands kingdoms. We had armed them with bows and arrows and swords, in addition to their own more primitive weapons. I had trained them in military discipline and in so much of the art of war as I had gleaned from the extensive reading of the campaigns of Napoleon, von Moltke, Grant, and the ancients. We had marked out as best we could natural boundaries dividing the various kingdoms. We had warned tribes beyond these boundaries that they must not trespass, and we had marched against and severely punished those who had. We had met and defeated the Mahars and the Sagoths. In short, we had demonstrated our rights to empire, and very rapidly we were being recognized and heralded abroad when my departure for the outer world and Hooja's treachery had set us back. But now I had returned. The work that fate had undone must be done again, and though I must needs smile at my imperial honors, I nonetheless felt the weight of duty and obligation that rested upon my shoulders. Slowly the Imperial Navy progressed toward completion. She was a wondrous craft, but I had my doubts about her. When I voiced them to Perry, he reminded me gently that my people for many generations had been mine owners, not shipbuilders, and consequently I couldn't be expected to know much about the matter. I was minded to inquire into his hereditary fitness to design battleships, but inasmuch as I already knew that his father had been a minister in a backwoods village far from the coast, I hesitated lest I offend the dear old fellow. He was immensely serious about his work, and I must admit that insofar as appearances went he did extremely well with the meager tools and assistance at his command. We had only two short axes and our hunting knives, yet with these we hewed trees, split them into planks, surfaced and fitted them. The Navy was some 40 feet in length by 10 feet beam. Her sides were quite straight and fully 10 feet high. "For the purpose," explained Perry, "of adding dignity to her appearance and rendering it less easy for an enemy to board her." As a matter of fact, I knew that he had had in mind the safety of her crew under javelin fire. The lofty sides made an admirable shelter. Inside she reminded me of nothing so much as a floating trench. There was also some slight analogy to a huge coffin. Her prow sloped sharply backward from the waterline, quite like a line of battleship. Perry had designed her more for morale effect upon an enemy, I think, than for any real harm she might inflict, and so those parts which were to show were the most imposing. Below the waterline she was practically non-existent. She should have had considerable draft, but as the enemy couldn't have seen it, Perry decided to do away with it, and so made her flat-bottomed. It was this that caused my doubts about her. There was another little idiosyncrasy of design that escaped us both until she was about ready to launch. There was no method of propulsion. Her sides were far too high to permit the use of sweeps, and when Perry suggested that we pole her, I remonstrated on the grounds that it would be a most undignified and awkward manner of sweeping down upon the foe, even if we could find or wield poles that would reach to the bottom of the ocean. Finally, I suggested that we convert her into a sailing vessel. When once the idea took hold, Perry was most enthusiastic about it, and nothing would do but a four-masted, full-rigged ship. Again I tried to dissuade him, but he was simply crazy over the psychological effect which the appearance of this strange and mighty craft would have upon the natives of Pellucidar. So we rigged her with thin hides for sails and dried gut for rope. Neither of us knew much about sailing a full-rigged ship, but that didn't worry me a great deal, for I was confident that we should never be called upon to do so, and as the day of launching approached I was positive of it. We had built her upon a low bank of the river close to where it emptied into the sea, and just above high tide. Her keel we had laid upon several rollers cut from small trees, the ends of the rollers in turn resting upon parallel tracks of long saplings. Her stern was toward the water. A few hours before we were ready to launch her, she made quite an imposing picture, for Perry had insisted upon setting every shred of canvas. I told him that I didn't know much about it, but I was sure that at launching the hull only should have been completed, everything else being completed after she had floated safely. At the last minute there was some delay while we sought a name for her. I wanted to christen her the Perry in honor both of her designer and that other great naval genius of another world, Captain Oliver Hazard Perry of the United States Navy, but Perry was too modest. He wouldn't hear of it. We finally decided to establish a system in the naming of the fleet. Battleships of the first class should bear the names of kingdoms of the Federation. armored cruisers the names of kings, cruisers the names of cities, and so on down the line. Therefore, we decided to name the first battleship Sari, after the first of the Federated Kingdoms. The launching of the Sari proved easier than I contemplated. Perry wanted me to get in and break something over the bow as she floated out upon the bosom of the river, but I told him that I should feel safer on dry land until I saw which side up the Sari would float. I could see by the expression of the old man's face that my words had hurt him, but I noticed that he didn't offer to get in himself, and so I felt less contrition than I might otherwise. When we cut the ropes and removed the blocks that held the Sari in place, she started for the water with a lunge. Before she hit it, she was going at a reckless speed, for we had laid our tracks quite down to the water, greased them, and at intervals placed rollers all ready to receive the ship as she moved forward with stately dignity. But there was no dignity in the Sari. When she touched the surface of the river, she must have been going 20 or 30 miles an hour. Her momentum carried her well out into the stream, until she came to a sudden halt at the end of the long line which we had had the foresight to attach to her bow and fasten to a large tree upon the bank. The moment her progress was checked, she promptly capsized. Perry was overwhelmed. I didn't upbraid him, nor remind him that I had told him so. His grief was so genuine and so apparent that I didn't have the heart to reproach him, even were I inclined to that particular sort of meanness. "Come, come, old man," I cried. "It's not as bad as it looks. Give me a hand with this rope, and we'll drag her up as far as we can, and then when the tide goes out we'll try another scheme. I think we can make a go of her yet." Well, we managed to get her up into shallow water. When the tide receded, she lay there on her side in the mud, quite a pitiable object for the premier battleship of a world. "The terror of the seas," was the way Perry had occasionally described her. We had to work fast, but before the tide came in again we had stripped her of her sails and masts, righted her, and filled her about a quarter full of rock ballast. If she didn't stick too fast in the mud, I was sure that she would float this time right side up. I can tell you that it was with palpitating hearts that we sat upon the river bank and watched that tide come slowly in. The tides of Pellucidar don't amount to much by comparison with our higher tides of the outer world, but I knew that it ought to prove ample to float the Sari. Nor was I mistaken. Finally, we had the satisfaction of seeing the vessel rise out of the mud and float slowly upstream with the tide. As the water rose, we pulled her in quite close to the bank and clambered aboard. She rested safely now upon an even keel, nor did she leak, for she was well caulked with fiber and tarry pitch. We rigged up a single short mast and light sail, fastened planking down over the ballast to form a deck, and worked her out into midstream with a couple of sweeps, and dropped our primitive stone anchor to await the turn of the tide that would bear us out to sea. While we waited, we devoted the time to the construction of an upper deck, since the one immediately above the ballast was some 7 feet from the gunwale. The second deck was 4 feet above this. In it was a large, commodious hatch, leading to the lower deck. The sides of the ship rose 3 feet above the upper deck, forming an excellent breastwork, which we loopholed at intervals that we might lie prone and fire upon an enemy. Though we were sailing out upon a peaceful mission in search of my friend Jah, we knew that we might meet with people of some other island, who would prove unfriendly. At last the tide turned. We weighed anchor. Slowly we drifted down the great river toward the sea. About us swarmed the mighty denizens of the primeval deep, Plesiosauri and Ichthyosauria with all their horrid, slimy cousins, whose names were as the names of aunts and uncles to Perry, but which I have never been able to recall an hour after having heard them. At last we were safely launched upon the journey to which we had looked forward for so long, and the results of which meant so much to me. End of chapter 3. Chapter 4 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 4. Friendship and Treachery. The Sari proved a most erratic craft. She might have done well enough upon a park lagoon if safely anchored, but upon the bosom of a mighty ocean she left much to be desired. Sailing with the wind she did her best, but in quartering or when close-hauled she drifted terribly, as a nautical man might have guessed she would. We couldn't keep within miles of our course, and our progress was pitifully slow. Instead of making for the island of Anorak, we bore far to the right, until it became evident that we should have to pass between the two right-hand islands and attempt to return toward Anorak from the opposite side. As we neared the islands, Parry was quite overcome by their beauty. When we were directly between two of them he fairly went into raptures, nor could I blame him. The tropical luxuriance of the foliage that dripped almost to the water's edge and the vivid colors of the blooms that shot the green made a most gorgeous spectacle. Parry was right in the midst of a flowery panegyric on the wonders of the peaceful beauty of the scene when a canoe shot out from the nearest island. There were a dozen warriors in it. It was quickly followed by a second and a third. Of course we couldn't know the intentions of the strangers, but we could pretty well guess them. Parry wanted to man the sweeps and try to get away from them, but I soon convinced him that any speed of which the Sari was capable would be far too slow to outdistance the swift, though awkward, dugouts of the Mizaps. I waited until they were quite close enough to hear me, and then I hailed them. I told them that we were friends of the Mizaps, and that we were upon a visit to Jah of Anorak, to which they replied that they were at war with Jah, and that if we would wait a minute they'd board us and throw our corpses to the Asdariths. I warned them that they would get the worst of it if they didn't leave us alone, but they only shouted in derision and paddled swiftly toward us. It was evident that they were considerably impressed by the appearance and dimensions of our craft, but as these fellows know no fear they were not at all awed. Seeing that they were determined to give battle, I leaned over the rail of the Sari and brought the Imperial battle squadron of the Emperor of Pellucidar into action for the first time in the history of a world. In other and simpler words, I fired my revolver at the nearest canoe. The effect was magical. A warrior rose from his knees, threw his paddle aloft, stiffened to rigidity for an instant, and then toppled overboard. The others ceased paddling, and with wide eyes looked first at me and then at the battling sea-things which fought for the corpse of their comrade. To them it must have seemed a miracle that I should be able to stand at thrice the range of their most powerful javelin-thrower, and with a loud noise and a smudge of smoke slay one of their number with an invisible missile. But only for an instant were they paralyzed with wonder. Then, with savage shouts, they fell once more to their paddles and forged rapidly toward us. Again and again I fired. At each shot a warrior sank to the bottom of the canoe or tumbled overboard. When the prow of the first craft touched the side of the Sari, it contained only dead and dying men. The other two dugouts were approaching rapidly, so I turned my attention toward them. I think that they must have been commencing to have some doubts, those wild, naked red warriors, for when the first man fell in the second boat the others stopped paddling and commenced to jabber among themselves. The third boat pulled up alongside the second, and its crews joined in the conference. Taking advantage of the lull in the battle, I called out to the survivors to return to their shore. "I have no fight with you," I cried, and then I told them who I was, and added that if they would live in peace they must sooner or later join forces with me. "Go back now to your people," I counseled them, "and tell them that you have seen David the First, Emperor of the Federated Kingdoms of Pellucidar, and that single-handed he has overcome you, just as he intends overcoming the Mahars and the Sagoths and any other peoples of Pellucidar who threaten the peace and welfare of his empire." Slowly they turned the noses of their canoes toward land. It was evident that they were impressed. Yet that they were loath to give up without further contesting my claim to naval supremacy was also apparent, for some of their number seemed to be exhorting the others to a renewal of the conflict. However, at last they drew slowly away, and the Sari, which had not decreased her snail-like speed during this, her first engagement, continued upon her slow, uneven way. Presently Parry stuck his head up through the hatch and hailed me.
"Have the scoundrels departed?" he asked. "Have you killed them all?"
"Those whom I failed to kill have departed, Parry," I replied. He came out on deck and, peering over the side, descried the lone canoe floating a short distance astern with its grim and grisly freight. Farther his eyes wandered to the retreating boats.
"David," he said at last, "this is a notable occasion. It is a great day in the annals of Pellucidar. We have won a glorious victory. Your Majesty's navy has routed a fleet of the enemy thrice its own size, manned by 10 times as many men. Let us give thanks."
I could scarce restrain a smile at Parry's use of the pronoun "we," yet I was glad to share the rejoicing with him, as I shall always be glad to share everything with the dear old fellow. Parry is the only male coward I have ever known whom I could respect and love. He was not created for fighting, but I think that if the occasion should ever arise where it became necessary, he would give his life cheerfully for me. Yes, I know it. It took us a long time to work around the islands and draw in close to Anorak. In the leisure afforded, we took turns working on our map, and by means of the compass and a little guesswork, we set down the shoreline we had left and the three islands with fair accuracy. Crossed sabers marked the spot where the first great naval engagement of a world had taken place. In a notebook we had jotted down, as had been our custom, details that would be of historical value later. Opposite Anorak we came to anchor quite close to the shore. I knew from my previous experience with the tortuous trails of the island that I could never find my way inland to the hidden tree village of the Mizop chieftain Ja, so we remained aboard the Sari, firing our express rifles at intervals to attract the attention of the natives. After some 10 shots had been fired at considerable intervals, a body of copper-colored warriors appeared upon the shore. They watched us for a moment, and then I hailed them, asking the whereabouts of my old friend Ja. They did not reply at once, but stood with their heads together in serious and animated discussion. Continually they turned their eyes toward our strange craft. It was evident that they were greatly puzzled by our appearance as well as unable to explain the source of the loud noises that had attracted their attention to us. At last one of the warriors addressed us.
"Who are you who seek Ja?" he asked. "What would you of our chief?"
"We are friends," I replied. "I am David. Tell Ja that David, whose life be once saved from a Scythic, has come again to visit him. If you will send out a canoe, we will come ashore. We cannot bring our great warship closer in."
Again they talked for a considerable time. Then two of them entered a canoe that several dragged from its hiding place in the jungle and paddled swiftly toward us. They were magnificent specimens of manhood. Parry had never seen a member of this red race close to before. In fact, the dead men in the canoe we had left astern after the battle, and the survivors who were paddling rapidly toward their shore, were the first he had ever seen. He had been greatly impressed by their physical beauty and the promise of superior intelligence which their well-shaped skulls gave. The two who now paddled out received us into their canoe with dignified courtesy. To my inquiries relative to Ja, they explained that he had not been in the village when our signals were heard, but that runners had been sent out after him, and that doubtless he was already upon his way to the coast. One of the men remembered me from the occasion of my former visit to the island. He was extremely agreeable the moment that he came close enough to recognize me. He said that Ja would be delighted to welcome me, and that all the tribe of Anorak knew of me by repute, and had received explicit instructions from their chieftain that if any of them should ever come upon me, to show me every kindness and attention. Upon shore we were received with equal honor. While we stood conversing with our bronze friends, a tall warrior leapt suddenly from the jungle. It was Jah. As his eyes fell upon me, his face lighted with pleasure. He came quickly forward to greet me after the manner of his tribe. Toward Perry he was equally hospitable. The old man fell in love with this savage giant as completely as had I. Jah conducted us along the maze-like trail to his strange village, where he gave over one of the tree-houses for our exclusive use. Perry was much interested in the unique habitation, which resembled nothing so much as a huge wasp's nest built around the bole of a tree well above the ground. After we had eaten and rested, Jah came to see us with a number of his headmen. They listened attentively to my story, which included a narrative of the events leading to the formation of the Federated Kingdoms, the battle with the Mahars, my journey to the Outer World, and my return to Pellucidar and search for Sari and my mate. Jah told me that the Mesops had heard something of the Federation and had been much interested in it. He had even gone so far as to send a party of warriors toward Sari to investigate the reports, and to arrange for the entrance of Anorak into the Empire in case it appeared that there was any truth in the rumors that one of the aims of the Federation was the overthrow of the Mahars. The delegation had met with a party of Sagoths. As there had been a truce between the Mahars and the Mesops for many generations, they camped with these warriors of the reptiles, from whom they learned that the Federation had gone to pieces. So the party returned to Anorak. When I showed Jah our map and explained its purpose to him, he was much interested. The location of Anorak, the Mountains of the Clouds, the river, and the strip of seacoast were all familiar to him. He quickly indicated the position of the inland sea and close beside it the city of Phutra, where one of the powerful Mahar nations had its seat. He likewise showed us where Sari should be, and carried his own coastline as far north and south as it was known to him. His additions to the map convinced us that Greenwich lay upon the verge of this same sea, and that it might be reached by water more easily than by the arduous crossing of the mountains or the dangerous approach through Phutra, which lay almost directly in line between Anorak and Greenwich to the northwest. If Sari lay upon the same water, then the shoreline must bend far back toward the southwest of Greenwich, an assumption which, by the way, we found later to be true. Also, Sari was upon a lofty plateau at the southern end of a mighty gulf of the great ocean. The location which Jah gave to distant Amaz puzzled us, for it placed it due north of Greenwich, apparently in mid-ocean. As Jah had never been so far and knew only of Amaz through hearsay, we thought that he must be mistaken. But he was not. Amaz lies directly north of Greenwich across the mouth of the same gulf as that upon which Sari is. The sense of direction and location of these primitive Pellucidarians is little short of uncanny, as I have had occasion to remark in the past. You may take one of them to the uttermost ends of his world, to places of which he has never even heard, yet without sun or moon or stars to guide him, without map or compass, he will travel straight for home in the shortest direction. Mountains, rivers, and seas may have to be gone around, but never once does his sense of direction fail him. The homing instinct is supreme. In the same remarkable way, they never forget the location of any place to which they have ever been, and know that of many of which they have only heard from others who have visited them. In short, each Pellucidarian is a walking geography of his own district, and of much of the country contiguous thereto. It always proved of the greatest aid to Perry and me. Nevertheless, we were anxious to enlarge our map, for we at least were not endowed with the homing instinct. After several long councils, it was decided that, in order to expedite matters, Perry should return to the Prospector with a strong party of Mesops, and fetch the freight I had brought from the Outer World. Jah and his warriors were much impressed by our firearms, and were also anxious to build boats with sails. As we had arms at the Prospector, and also books on boat-building, we thought that it might prove an excellent idea to start these naturally maritime people upon the construction of a well-built navy of staunch sailing vessels. I was sure that, With definite plans to go by, Perry could oversee the construction of an adequate flotilla. I warned him, however, not to be too ambitious, and to forget about dreadnoughts and armored cruisers for a while, and build instead a few small sailing boats that could be manned by 4 or 5 men. I was to proceed to Sari, and while prosecuting my search for Dian, attempt at the same time the rehabilitation of the Federation. Perry was going as far as possible by water, with the chances that the entire trip might be made in that manner which proved to be the fact. With a couple of Mesops as companions, I started for Sari. In order to avoid crossing the principal range of the Mountains of the Clouds, we took a route that passed a little way south of Phutra. We had eaten 4 times and slept once, and were, as my companions told me, not far from the great Mahar city, when we were suddenly confronted by a considerable band of Sagoths. They did not attack us, owing to the peace which exists between the Mahars and the Mesops, but I could see that they looked upon me with considerable suspicion. My friends told them that I was a stranger from a remote country, and as we had previously planned against such a contingency, I pretended ignorance of the language which the human beings of Pellucidar employed in conversing with the guerrilla-like soldiery of the Mahars. I noticed, and not without misgivings, that the leader of the Sagoths eyed me with an expression that betokened partial recognition. I was sure that he had seen me before during the period of my incarceration in Phutra, and that he was trying to recall my identity. It worried me not a little. I was extremely thankful when we bade them adieu and continued upon our journey. Several times during the next few marches I became acutely conscious of the sensation of being watched by unseen eyes, but I did not speak of my suspicions to my companions. Later I had reason to regret my reticence, for, well, this is how it happened. We had killed an antelope, and after eating our fill I had lain down to sleep. The Pellucidarians, who seem seldom if ever to require sleep, joined me in this instance, for we had a very trying march along the northern foothills of the Mountains of the Clouds, and now, with their bellies filled with meat, they seemed ready for slumber. When I awoke it was with a start to find a couple of huge Sagoths astride me. They pinioned my arms and legs, and later chained my wrists behind my back. Then they let me up. I saw my companions. The brave fellows lay dead where they had slept, javelined to death without a chance at self-defense. I was furious. I threatened the Sagoth leader with all sorts of dire reprisals. But when he heard me speak the hybrid language that is the medium of communication between his kind and the human race of the inner world, he only grinned, as much as to say, "I thought so." They had not taken my revolvers or ammunition away from me, because they did not know what they were, but my heavy rifle I had lost. They simply left it where it had lain beside me. So low in the scale of intelligence are they, that they had not sufficient interest in this strange object even to fetch it along with them. I knew from the direction of our march that they were taking me to Phutra. Once there, I did not need much of an imagination to picture what my fate would be. It was the arena and a wild thag or fierce tarag for me, unless the Mahars elected to take me to the pits. In that case my end would be no more certain, though infinitely more horrible and painful, for in the pits I should be subjected to cruel vivisection. From what I had once seen of their methods in the pits of Phutra, I knew them to be the opposite of merciful, whereas in the arena I should be quickly dispatched by some savage beast. Arrived at the underground city, I was taken immediately before a slimy Mahar. When the creature had received the report of the Sagoth, its cold eyes glistened with malice and hatred as they were turned balefully upon me. I knew then that my identity had been guessed. With a show of excitement that I had never before seen evinced by a member of the dominant race of Pellucidar, the Mahar hustled me away, heavily guarded, through the main avenue of the city to one of the principal buildings. Here we were ushered into a great hall where presently many Mahars gathered. In utter silence they conversed, for they have no oral speech since they are without auditory nerves. Their method of communication Perry has likened to the projection of a sixth sense into a fourth dimension, where it becomes cognizable to the sixth sense of their audience. Be that as it may, however, it was evident that I was the subject of the discussion, and from the hateful looks bestowed upon me, not a particularly pleasant subject. How long I waited for their decision I do not know, but it must have been a very long time. Finally, one of the Sagoths addressed me. He was acting as interpreter for his masters. "The Mahars will spare your life," he said, "and release you on one condition." "And what is that condition?" I asked, though I could guess its terms. "That you return to them that which you stole from the pits of Phutra when you killed the four Mahars and escaped," he replied. I had thought that that would be it. The great secret upon which depended the continuance of the Mahar race was safely hid where only Dian and I knew. I ventured to imagine that they would have given me much more than my liberty to have it safely in their keeping again. But after that, what? Would they keep their promises? I doubted it. With the secret of artificial propagation once more in their hands, their numbers would soon be made so to overrun the world of Pellucidar that there could be no hope for the eventual supremacy of the human race, the cause for which I so devoutly hoped, for which I had consecrated my life, and for which I was not willing to give my life. Yes, in that moment, as I stood before the heartless tribunal, I felt that my life would be a very little thing to give could it save to the human race of Pellucidar the chance to come into its own by ensuring the eventual extinction of the hated, powerful Mahars. "Come," exclaimed the Sagoths, "the mighty Mahars await your reply." "You may say to them," I answered, "that I shall not tell them where the great secret is hid." When this had been translated to them, there was a great beating of reptilian wings, gaping of sharp fang jaws, and hideous hissing. I thought that they were about to fall upon me on the spot, and so I laid my hands upon my revolvers. But at length they became more quiet, and presently transmitted some command to my Sagoth guard, the chief of which laid a heavy hand upon my arm and pushed me roughly before him from the audience chamber. They took me to the pits, where I lay carefully guarded. I was sure that I was to be taken to the vivisection laboratory, and it required all my courage to fortify myself against the terrors of so fearful a death. In Pellucidar, where there is no time, death agonies may endure for eternities. Accordingly, I had to steel myself against an endless doom, which now stared me in the face. End of chapter 4. Chapter 5 of Pellucidar by Edgar Rice Burroughs. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Pellucidar. Chapter 5. Surprises. But at last the allotted moment arrived, the moment for which I had been trying to prepare myself, for how long I could not even guess. A great Sagoth came and spoke some words of command to those who watched over me. I was jerked roughly to my feet and, with little consideration, hustled upward toward the higher levels. Out into the broad avenue they conducted me, where, amid huge throngs of Mahars, Sagoths, and heavily guarded slaves, I was led, or rather pushed and shoved roughly, along in the same direction that the mob moved. I had seen such a concourse of people once before in the buried city of Phutra. I guessed, and rightly, that we were bound for the great arena where slaves who are condemned to death meet their end. Into the vast amphitheatre they took me, stationing me at the extreme end of the arena. The queen came, with her slimy, sickening retinue. The seats were filled. The show was about to commence. Then, from a little doorway in the opposite end of the structure, a girl was led into the arena. She was at a considerable distance from me. I could not see her features. I wondered what fate awaited this other poor victim and myself, and why they had chosen to have us die together. My own fate, or rather my thought of it, was submerged in the natural pity I felt for this lone girl, doomed to die horribly beneath the cold, cruel eyes of her awful captors. Of what crime could she be guilty that she must expiate it in the dreaded arena? As I stood thus thinking, another door, this time at one of the long sides of the arena, was thrown open, and into the theater of death slunk a mighty Tarag, the huge cave-tiger of the Stone Age. At my sides were my revolvers. My captors had not taken them from me, because they did not yet realize their nature. Doubtless they thought them some strange manner of war-club, and as those who are condemned to the arena are permitted weapons of defense, they let me keep them. The girl they had armed with a javelin. A brass pin would have been almost as effective against the ferocious monster they had loosed upon her. The Tarag stood for a moment looking about him, first up at the vast audience and then about the arena. He did not seem to see me at all, but his eyes fell presently upon the girl. A hideous roar broke from his titanic lungs, a roar which ended in a long-drawn scream that is more human than the death cry of a tortured woman, more human but more awesome. I could scarce restrain a shudder. Slowly the beast turned and moved toward the girl. Then it was that I came to myself and to a realization of my duty. Quickly and as noiselessly as possible, I ran down the arena in pursuit of the grim creature. As I ran, I drew one of my pitifully futile weapons. Ah, could I but have had my lost express gun in my hands at that moment! A single well-placed shot would have crumbled even this great monster. The best I could hope to accomplish was to divert the thing from the girl to myself, and then to place as many bullets as possible in it before it reached and mauled me into insensibility and death. There is a certain unwritten law of the arena that vouchsafes freedom and immunity to the victor, be he beast or human being, both of whom, by the way, are all the same to the Mahar. That is, they were accustomed to look upon man as a lower animal before Parry and I broke through the Pellucidarian crust. But I imagine that they were beginning to alter their views a trifle, and to realize that in the Gilak, their word for human being, they had a highly organized, reasoning being to contend with. Be that as it may, the chances were that the Tarag alone would profit by the law of the arena. A few more of his long strides, a prodigious leap, and he would be upon the girl. I raised a revolver and fired. The bullet struck him in the left hind leg. It couldn't have damaged him much, but the report of the shot brought him around, facing me. I think the snarling visage of a huge, enraged, saber-toothed tiger is one of the most terrible sights in the world, especially if he be snarling at you, and there be nothing between the two of you but bare sand. Even as he faced me, a little cry from the girl carried my eyes beyond the brute to her face. Hers was fastened upon me with an expression of incredulity that baffles description. There was both hope and horror in them too. "Dian!" I cried. "My heavens, Dian!" I saw her lips form the name David, as with raised javelin she rushed forward upon the Tarag. She was a tigress then, a primitive savage female defending her loved one. Before she could reach the beast with her puny weapon, I fired again at the point where the Tarag's neck met his left shoulder. If I could get a bullet through there, it might reach his heart. The bullet didn't reach his heart, but it stopped him for an instant. It was then that a strange thing happened. I heard a great hissing from the stands occupied by the Mahars, and as I glanced toward them I saw three mighty Thipdars, the winged dragons that guard the Queen, or as Parry calls them, pterodactyls, rise swiftly from their rocks and dart lightning-like toward the center of the arena. They are huge, powerful reptiles. One of them, with the advantage which his wings might give him, would easily be a match for a cave bear or a Tarag. These three, to my consternation, swooped down upon the Tarag as he was gathering himself for a final charge upon me. They buried their talons in his back and lifted him bodily from the arena as if he had been a chicken in the clutches of a hawk. What could it mean? I was baffled for an explanation, but with the Tareq gone I lost no time in hastening to Dian's side. With a little cry of delight she threw herself into my arms. So lost were we in the ecstasy of reunion that neither of us, to this day, can tell what became of the Tareq. The first thing we were aware of was the presence of a body of Sagoths about us. Gruffly they commanded us to follow them. They led us from the arena and back through the streets of Phutra to the audience chamber, in which I had been tried and sentenced. Here we found ourselves facing the same cold, cruel tribunal. Again a Sagoth acted as interpreter. He explained that our lives had been spared because at the last moment Tu al-Sa had returned to Phutra, and seeing me in the arena had prevailed upon the queen to spare my life. "Who is Tu al-Sa?" I asked. "A Mahar whose last male ancestor was, ages ago, the last of the male rulers among the Mahars," he replied. "Why should she wish to have my life spared?" He shrugged his shoulders and then repeated my question to the Mahar spokesman. When the latter had explained in the strange sign language that passes for speech between the Mahars and their fighting men, the Sagoth turned again to me. "For a long time you had Tu al-Sa in your power," he explained. "You might easily have killed her or abandoned her in a strange world, but you did neither. You did not harm her, and you brought her back with you to Pellucidar and set her free to return to Phutra. This is your reward." Now I understood. The Mahar, who had been my involuntary companion upon my return to the outer world, was Tu al-Sa. This was the first time that I had learned the lady's name. I thanked fate that I had not left her upon the sands of the Sahara, or put a bullet in her, as I had been tempted to do. I was surprised to discover that gratitude was a characteristic of the dominant race of Pellucidar. I could never think of them as aught but cold-blooded, brainless reptiles, though Perry had devoted much time in explaining to me that owing to a strange freak of evolution among all the genera of the inner world, this species of the Reptilia had advanced to a position quite analogous to that which man holds upon the outer crust. He had often told me that there was every reason to believe from their writings, which he had learned to read while we were incarcerated in Phutra, that they were a just race and that in certain branches of sciences and arts they were quite well advanced, especially in genetics and metaphysics, engineering and architecture. While it had always been difficult for me to look upon these things as other than slimy, winged crocodiles, which, by the way, they do not at all resemble, I was now forced to a realization of the fact that I was in the hands of enlightened creatures, for justice and gratitude are certain hallmarks of rationality and culture. But what they purposed for us further was of most imminent interest to me. They might save us from the Tareq and yet not free us. They looked upon us yet, to some extent I knew, as creatures of a lower order, and so, as we were unable to place ourselves in the position of the brutes we enslave, thinking that they are happier in bondage than in the free fulfillment of the purposes for which nature intended them, the Mahars, too, might consider our welfare better conserved in captivity than among the dangers of the savage freedom we craved. Naturally, I was next impelled to inquire their further intent. To my question, put through the Sagoth interpreter, I received the reply that having spared my life they considered that Tu al-Sa's debt of gratitude was cancelled. They still had against me, however, the crime of which I had been guilty, the unforgivable crime of stealing the great secret. They, therefore, intended holding Dian and me prisoners until the manuscript was returned to them. They would, they said, send an escort of Sagoths with me to fetch the precious document from its hiding place, keeping Dian at Phutra as a hostage, and releasing us both the moment that the document was safely restored to their queen. There was no doubt but that they had the upper hand. However, there was so much more at stake than the liberty or even the lives of Dian and myself that I did not deem it expedient to accept their offer without giving the matter careful thought. Without the great secret, this maleless race must eventually become extinct. For ages they had fertilized their eggs by an artificial process, the secret of which lay hidden in the little cave of a far-off valley where Dian and I had spent our honeymoon. I was none too sure that I could find the valley again, nor that I cared to. So long as the powerful reptilian race of Pellucidar continued to propagate, just so long would the position of man within the inner world be jeopardized. There could not be two dominant races. I said as much to Dian.
"You used to tell me," she replied, "of the wonderful things you could accomplish with the inventions of your own world. Now you have returned with all that is necessary to place this great power in the hands of the men of Pellucidar. You told me of the great engines of destruction which would cast a bursting ball of metal among our enemies, killing hundreds of them at one time. You told me of mighty fortresses of stone which a thousand men armed with big and little engines such as these could hold forever against a million Sagoths. You told me of great canoes which moved across the water without paddles, and which spat death from holes in their sides. All these may now belong to the men of Pellucidar. Why should we fear the Mahars? Let them breed. Let their numbers increase by thousands. They will be helpless before the power of the Emperor of Pellucidar. But if you remain a prisoner in Phutra, what may we accomplish? What could the men of Pellucidar do without you to lead them? They would fight among themselves, and while they fought, the Mahars would fall upon them, and even though the Mahar race should die out, of what value would the emancipation of the human race be to them without the knowledge, which you alone may wield to guide them toward the wonderful civilization of which you have told me so much, that I long for its comforts and luxuries as I never before longed for anything. No, David, the Mahars cannot harm us if you are at liberty. Let them have their secret, that you and I may return to our people and lead them to the conquest of all Pellucidar." It was plain that Dian was ambitious, and that her ambition had not dulled her reasoning faculties. She was right. Nothing could be gained by remaining bottled up in Phutra for the rest of our lives. It was true that Perry might do much with the contents of the prospector, or iron mole, in which I had brought down the implements of the outer world civilization. But Perry was a man of peace. He could never weld the warring factions of the disrupted Federation. He could never win new tribes to the Empire. He would fiddle around manufacturing gunpowder and trying to improve upon it until someone blew him up with his own invention. He wasn't practical. He never would get anywhere without a balance wheel, without someone to direct his energies. Perry needed me, and I needed him. If we were going to do anything for Pellucidar, we must be free to do it together. The outcome of it all was that I agreed to the Mahars' proposition. They promised that Dian would be well treated and protected from every indignity during my absence. So I set out with 100 Sagoths in search of the little valley which I had stumbled upon by accident, and which I might and might not find again. We traveled directly toward Sari. Stopping at the camp where I had been captured, I recovered my express rifle, for which I was very thankful. I found it lying where I had left it, when I had been overpowered in my sleep by the Sagoths who had captured me and slain my Mesop companions. On the way I added materially to my map, an occupation which did not elicit from the Sagoths even a shadow of interest. I felt that the human race of Pellucidar had little to fear from these guerrilla men. They were fighters, that was all. We might even use them later ourselves in this same capacity. They had not sufficient brain power to constitute a menace to the advancement of the human race. As we neared the spot where I hoped to find the little valley, I became more and more confident of success. Every landmark was familiar to me,
and I was sure now that I knew the exact location of the cave. It was at about this time that I sighted a number of the half-naked warriors of the human race of Pellucidar. They were marching across our front. At sight of us they halted. That there would be a fight I could not doubt. These Sagoths would never permit an opportunity for the capture of slaves for their Mahar masters to escape them. I saw that the men were armed with bows and arrows, long lances and swords, so I guessed that they must have been members of the Federation, for only my people had been thus equipped. Before Perry and I came, the men of Pellucidar had only the crudest weapons wherewith to slay one another. The Sagoths, too, were evidently expecting battle. With savage shouts they rushed forward toward the human warriors. Then a strange thing happened. The leader of the human beings stepped forward with upraised hands. The Sagoths ceased their war cries and advanced slowly to meet him. There was a long parley during which I could see that I was often the subject of their discourse. The Sagoth's leader pointed in the direction in which I had told them the valley lay. Evidently, he was explaining the nature of our expedition to the leader of the warriors. It was all a puzzle to me. What human being could be upon such excellent terms with the gorilla men? I couldn't imagine. I tried to get a good look at the fellow, but the Sagoths had left me in the rear with a guard when they had advanced to battle, and the distance was too great for me to recognize the features of any of the human beings. Finally, the parley was concluded and the men continued on their way while the Sagoths returned to where I stood with my guard. It was time for eating, so we stopped where we were and made our meal. The Sagoths didn't tell me who it was they had met, and I did not ask, though I must confess that I was quite curious. They permitted me to sleep at this halt. Afterward, we took up the last leg of our journey. I found the valley without difficulty and led my guard directly to the cave. At its mouth, the Sagoths halted and I entered alone. I noticed as I felt about the floor in the dim light that there was a pile of fresh-turned rubble there. Presently, my hands came to the spot where the great secret had been buried. There was a cavity where I had carefully smoothed the earth over the hiding place of the document. The manuscript was gone. Frantically, I searched the whole interior of the cave several times over, but without other result than a complete confirmation of my worst fears. Someone had been here ahead of me and stolen the great secret. The one thing within Pellucidar which might free Dian and me was gone, nor was it likely that I should ever learn its whereabouts. If a Mahar had found it, which was quite improbable, the chances were that the dominant race would never divulge the fact that they had recovered the precious document. If a caveman had happened upon it, he would have no conception of its meaning or value, and as a consequence it would be lost or destroyed in short order. With bowed head and broken hopes I came out of the cave and told the Sagoth chieftain what I had discovered. It didn't mean much to the fellow, who doubtless had but little better idea of the contents of the document I had been sent to fetch to his masters than would the caveman who in all probability had discovered it. The Sagoth knew only that I had failed in my mission, so he took advantage of the fact to make the return journey to Phutra as disagreeable as possible. I did not rebel, though I had with me the means to destroy them all. I did not dare rebel because of the consequences to Dian. I intended demanding her release on the grounds that she was in no way guilty of the theft, and that my failure to recover the document had not lessened the value of the good faith I had had in offering to do so. The Mahars might keep me in slavery if they chose, but Dian should be returned safely to her people. I was full of my scheme when we entered Phutra, and I was conducted directly to the great audience chamber. The Mahars listened to the report of the Sagoth chieftain, and so difficult is it to judge their emotions from their almost expressionless countenance that I was at a loss to know how terrible might be their wrath as they learned that their great secret, upon which rested the fate of their race, might now be irretrievably lost. Presently I could see that she who presided was communicated something to the Sagoth interpreter, doubtless something to be transmitted to me which might give me a forewarning of the fate which lay in store for me. One thing I had decided definitely. If they would not free Dian, I should turn loose upon Phutra with my little arsenal. Alone I might even win to freedom, and if I could learn where Dian was imprisoned, it would be worth the attempt to free her. My thoughts were interrupted by the interpreter. "The mighty Mahars," he said, "are unable to reconcile your statement that the document is lost with your action in sending it to them by a special messenger. They wish to know if you have so soon forgotten the truth, or if you are merely ignoring it." "I sent them no document," I cried. "Ask them what they mean." "They say," he went on, after conversing with the Mahar for a moment, "that just before your return to Phutra, Hooja the Sly One came, bringing the great secret with him. He said that you had sent him ahead with it, asking him to deliver it and return to Sari, where you would await him, bringing the girl with him." "Dian?" I gasped. "The Mahars have given over Dian into the keeping of Hooja!" "Surely," he replied. "What of it? She is only a Gilak. As you or I would say, she is only a cow." End of chapter 5.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.